everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio. And we have with us again Professor Richard Sloan. Professor Sloan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Hello, everybody.
Hello. And you have some current events that you want to discuss.
Yeah, I've just, not a lot. This may be a short podcast, but I've got a few recent headlines about Donald Trump from the New York Times. And most of the news in and of itself will probably be familiar to your audience, but I thought, let's just kind of review, what the headlines are, because we kind of forget the stories as time goes by, and people tend to only remember the headlines. A lot of people only catch the headlines. A lot of people only read the headlines, or they only hear the headlines. But let's kind of remember what some of these stories were about, if it's okay with you.
Okay.
I want to start with this one, I guess. Okay, here's one of my favorites. The headline from the New York Times says, Trump casino's tax debt was $30 million, mm-hmm. Period. Then Christie took office, period. You usually don't have periods in headlines, but can you guess the reason that there are periods in this headline?
Well, to make two perhaps unrelated pieces of information seem like cause and effect?
Exactly. It's circumstantial. But the New York Times can't say Christie took office and reduced Trump's tax debt, because you can read the whole article and there's not a piece of evidence in the article that show. Actually, there's a quote toward the end of the article where somebody in the New Jersey state government says that Christie did not preside over those hearings and didn't have anything to do with them. Mm-hmm. So it's really the only way you can do it is the New York Times is suggesting that because Christie took office, Trump's casino tax debt in the state of New Jersey was reduced, and the only way you can have it, you can make it seem like there's a logical connection when there isn't, is to have two separate sentences and to put the periods there. So I don't know how well you remember this story, but the story is actually about some taxes that Trump contested, and if you read the article, it says that eventually the state agreed to accept 17 cents on the dollar, roughly 17 cents on the dollar. Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen until Chris Christie became governor of the state. And so it was because, well, we're to infer that it was because Chris Christie became governor that Trump's tax debt was reduced.
Okay.
Do you remember this very well at all?
I'm not familiar at all with the taxation issue. Trump had one or more casinos in Atlantic City. Atlantic City, starting in the 1970s.
That's it. These are them. And then they went bankrupt.
They went bankrupt, as did, I believe, a number of other casinos. Atlantic City's really not that nice of a place. I went to Atlantic City as a very young man, and I think the first casino was called the Resorts Casino. I think that's what it was called. It began with an R, but I went. And I had hitchhiked there. I only had like maybe $7 or $8, and I put down a $5 bet on roulette and lost it. And so I thought, okay, well, I've got about $3 left. There's a place over on, what's the name of it? Brigantine Island, which is just across a little waterway from Atlantic City. I said, there's an Italian restaurant in Brigantine Island where I can get a bowl of spaghetti for about $2. So I was on my way walking there. And I was walking through, it was either Baltic Avenue or Mediterranean Avenue. It was one of the $2 rent places on the Monopoly board, which, of course, is based on Atlantic City. And the reason it's $2 rent is apparently because it's a black ghetto. And kids started throwing rocks and bricks at me.
Wow.
While parents sitting on the porches laughed, well, or at least watched and didn't object. And I didn't know what to do. I thought, well, if I run, and I'm running around a corner and, a new street, if I run onto Baltic Avenue or Orient Avenue and there's kids chasing me, who knows what's going to happen? And some of these kids are probably faster than me. So I just tried to remain calm and walk as if nothing was happening. And I got out there without being hit directly by any rocks. But yeah, that's my little aside. So,
What you should have done is you should have headed for community chest.
I suppose so, or get out of jail free. But so Atlantic City. One of the problems with Atlantic City is there's a giant ghetto around it, and so that probably has something to do with the reason that it didn't develop as well as a high-class resort as it might have. But it was the only place outside of Nevada in the 1970s and 80s that allowed gambling. There was no Indian casinos, there was nothing, no riverboat casinos. If you didn't want to leave the country or go to Nevada, the only way to gamble was to go to New Jersey, and to Atlantic City. And so the casinos initially did well, but once you didn't have to put your life on the line on one of those low-rent avenues from the Monopoly Board, people weren't so interested in going to Atlantic City. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you with that, but...
That's okay. I want your listeners to remember this story for what it was, because I think that a lot of people just remember the headlines. And, you know, there are so many, like, news venues on the internet that will pick up a New York Times story, and their only source will be the New York Times story. And they'll even make the headline sort of saucier than this. But this is a pretty sneaky and saucy headline, I think. Trump Casino's tax debt was worth $30 million, period. Then Christie took office. I want to point out that you read the article, and never was the debt as high as $30 million. It was $29.4 million at the highest. So in New York Times ease, $30 million, I guess, means $29.4 million. But if you read on, you find out that after the auditors did their audit, it was $8 million. I'm actually scrolling down to make sure I have that right. I think it was somewhere around $8 million. And then there were taxes and penalties added. And if anybody has moved to another state, maybe you're from Arizona and you get a parking ticket in Arizona, and then the next day you're off to university in Wyoming. And then a year goes by, or 2 years go by, and then you come back to Arizona, and there's a letter in the mail from the county, and it says, you now owe $516 for your parking ticket.
Yeah, interest and penalties, yeah.
Right, you have a heart attack. But then you go to the judge and you say, I was, the original ticket was only $62, and you tell the judge I was out of the state, and the judge says, okay, well, you know, these ultra-high penalties were just to get you to come into the court. You pay $62 plus a $15 fee or something. You're out the door for less than $100. Mm-hmm. That's the way it works, is all of these extra penalties and everything get added on so that, you know, because the court gets tired of waiting around and they want to bring you to the bargaining table and they want this to be resolved. Mm-hmm. My guess from reading this article is Donald Trump had, you know, he had a good case, and the city also had, or the county also had a good case, and they probably settled for about 50 cents on the dollar. But when the audit was finished, the tax debt was nowhere near, you know, $29.4 million or $30 million. It was the penalties and the fees and, you know, the punitive bits that they put on to get you to the bargaining table that made the debt so high. But you wouldn't get that from reading the headline. It's an interesting article if anybody wants to dig it up and read it, because it talks about how Trump had the casinos, how he took advantage of the Bankruptcy Protection Act in the state, and he went bankrupt, and then he didn't pay his fees for a while because he contested a few things. And interspersed with that, there's how Trump and his wife went out on a double date with Chris Christie and his wife. Mm-hmm. And then it goes back to the tax issue for a few paragraphs, and then it comes back to, and even recently, Trump and Chris Christie have been out on a double date. And it's almost like, you know, watching a television sitcom where you've got an A story and a B story. You have these cutaways to Chris Christie and Trump going out on a double date, but it has no relevance to the case. And it even admits toward the end of the article that Chris Christie wasn't in the room when Trump was given that break. And when he wound up, I think, paying $4 million or $5 million. I think he wound up paying $5 million. I think the debt when the auditors got through was $8 million. But then there would have been interest on top of the $8 million. And so paying $5 million was probably the equivalent of paying half of what he owed plus the interest, which is, I guess, how it was settled. But it's so deceptive. So I just wanted to start with that one. We won't spend as much time on every one of them, but just, you know, for a couple, if we could, you know, get past the headline and remember what the story was.
Okay, so what's the next headline?
Next headline is what Donald J. Trump owns and owes. And it's an article that appeared in the New York Times on August 20th. And it has a list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 15 or 20 properties and the debt outstanding for all of those properties. So like 40 Wall Street in Manhattan, his debt outstanding is $157 million. Trump International Hotel, in Washington. His debt outstanding is $127 million. And that's really at the very top. Well, I was going to say at the very top of the article. It looks like that's basically all the article is, except for a few sentences under that, is that chart of what he owns and what he owes. And a lot of people are going to look at that, and a lot of people are going to think, oh, the guy's a shyster, the guy's a fraud, because he's supposed to be this real estate tycoon, and he owes all of this money. But that's basically how the real estate business works, mm-hmm. is if you put all your money into your properties, you can only own two or three properties. Mm-hmm. But if you have, you know, the miracle of compounding interest loans working for you, and you're having your tenants pay off the loans, you know, you can hedge one against the next, and you can own a lot of properties. And so it's not like Trump has these massive gambling losses and he's borrowing against his properties to pay off the gambling losses. He's putting the minimal amount into the property that he needs to secure the loan, and then he's letting his tenants pay off the monthly mortgage on the properties.
Yeah. And so yeah, I mean, there's a certain risk there, but if you're good at what you're doing, then you take $1 million and turn it into $9 or $8 billion, which is what I guess he claims to have $8 to $9 billion or something like that, $10 billion. And if you're not good at it, then you lose your money and you go on and do something else.
Right, but let's remember that's his business, or that was his business, mm-hmm. is he was in the real estate business. And that's how they do it. That's how you do it in real estate. If your listeners know somebody who are professional investors in real estate, go up to those people and ask them how much of the purchase price of the property you put down when you buy the property. Everybody buys on credit and hedges one against the other, and that's how you get a lot of properties.
Yeah, and of course, even if you're only buying one property, that's how people buy their one property that they live in.
Right. Yeah, I mean, most people... If you're living in a $100,000 home, you put $10,000 down, and you carry a $90,000 loan. And if you win the lottery the next day, and you win $100,000, your accountant, if you have an accountant, is going to tell you, no, don't use that money to pay off your 5% interest loan. You can invest it in this, you know, this investment or that investment. You can get a 10% return or a 15% return.
Mm-hmm.
So most people, even if they have the money, they don't want to sink it into the property. They want to use it to do other investing.
Exactly. Okay.
That wasn't a very saucy headline. The first two or three that I wanted to talk about at the end, I wanted to sort of get into the nuts and bolts of the story.
Okay.
This is another one of those cases. I want to just quickly talk about this. We will, or your audience will probably remember this, because I think that this ghostwriter, his name is Tony Schwartz, has been on Good Morning America. He's been on a lot of talk shows, and people probably saw him on TV. The New York Times had a story called whose title was, "I Feel a Deep Sense of Remorse, Donald Trump's Ghostwriter Says." And then it's a story about Tony Schwartz, who they're calling him a ghostwriter, but he actually got credit on the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody sees Art of the Deal in a bookstore, pull it out and look at it, and it will say by Donald J. Trump and Tony Schwartz, or with Tony Schwartz, or something like that. It's clear that Tony Schwartz was the writer who hacked it out, but the way those books are written is Tony Schwartz spent time with Donald Trump, and he got his story, and then he wrote the story.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall this particular bit of news that went around for a while?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, this man, Tony Schwartz, for some reason, Donald Trump was making a claim or a statement at either a press conference or a rally or something. And he said, you know, we need a president that can make deals. This country needs it. I'm paraphrasing. I don't know if these are Donald Trump's exact words. But the president of this country should be the guy who wrote the Art of the Deal. And Tony Schwartz tweeted out that I should be president, you know, because in his mind, he wrote it because he spent time in a room with Donald Trump and recorded him and then went into a room and typed it all up. And somebody discovered him, and that just kind of snowballed. And the next thing you know, he's on talk shows, and he's doing an interview with the New Yorker magazine, and he's talking about how he went through all this remorse, and he regrets now that he made Donald Trump look so good, and he wasn't sure originally how he was going to write the article. He thought that he would make Donald Trump look good because he thought it would sell more books that way. but Donald Trump was a fraud and Donald Trump was an incoherent person and Donald Trump couldn't even speak a single coherent sentence. And he struggled so hard to make the man look human and come out as a sympathetic human being on the page. And he did that so that the sales of the book would be positive, because he never intended to be a ghostwriter, but, you know, you have to start somewhere. And now he regrets so much that he gave this guy a leg up, because the guy may actually become president of the United States, and he's incoherent and he can't make a single sentence. And it's all Tony Schwartz that you're reading if you read Donald Trump's book.
So what is Tony Schwartz's background? Do you know?
Well, I think he's gone on to do other kinds of writing. We could look him up on the internet now, but I think that was his sort of first foot in the door. Or you mean ethnic background?
Ethnic, yeah, or anything else, but ethnic is really the main thing I'm interested in, yeah.
Well, I think he's Jewish, if that's, okay. That's what you're going.
All right.
It really seems to me that Tony Schwartz, he got on TV, and I think a lot of people listened to him, and, you know, he seemed so sad and remorseful about, you know, what have I done? And he had a sympathetic story. But as somebody who's actually done ghostwriting, it doesn't ring true. Tony Schwartz was nobody. It's not like Donald Trump's is a name and Tony Schwartz is nobody, and Random House goes to Tony Schwartz and says, Tony Schwartz, we want you to tell Donald Trump's story, and we want you to do it however you want to tell it. You could make him sympathetic if you choose to make him sympathetic. If you don't think he's sympathetic, write him however you want to write it. You know, Tony Schwartz was hired to write a certain kind of book, and that was his job. Mm-hmm. And he's making it seem now like he made the conscious decision to make Donald Trump seem sympathetic because he thought that that would sell more books. You talk a lot with Don Advo.
Yeah, I was just going to say, with Tony Schwartz, it's not as if he had his own independent background in deal making. It's not as if he was a professor at an economics place and had looked into all this and was just using Donald Trump's name to get his own ideas out there, right?
Right. I mean, if you read the book, the book is full of simple sentences describing, like, the first chapter is what Donald Trump does through in a day. I'm on the phone and I'm thinking, should I call my broker and sell these shares or not? I could try for a buyout and I could try to buy this hotel chain, but I think I'm going to go ahead and sell and take the profit, and maybe another time I'll do this other thing.
Okay.
I mean, I don't see how you kind of invent that.
Right.
Here's, you know, I mean, Donald Trump would have been making those phone calls. He would have been talking about himself. Go ahead. You were about to say
something. No. Okay, well, here's the headline from the Jewish Daily Ford newspaper, okay? It says, Donald Trump's Jewish ghostwriter regrets putting lipstick on a pig. And then it shows his tweet from Tony Schwartz. Many thanks, Donald Trump, for suggesting I run for president based on the fact that I wrote The Art of the Deal. No plan to accept the draft.
Okay, I'm gonna be a surrogate Don Advo. I'm gonna say something that Don Advo would say. Before I say that, though, I want to have you guess. Tony Schwartz co-wrote, or if he wants to call himself a ghostwriter, he was the ghostwriter. Or if he wants to call himself the author, fine. But the book was in the bookstores. It said by Donald Trump and Tony Schwartz. What percentage of the royalties do you think that Tony Schwartz got?
I don't know. Did he get half?
50%.
He got 50%.
50%. That's an amazing deal for a ghostwriter.
Uh-huh.
The advance that they got on that book was $500,000. So Tony Schwartz got $250,000 for sitting in a room with Donald Trump and a tape recorder, and then going to another room and listening to the tapes and typing it out. And, you know, of course he had to edit, and of course there's a little skill involved. I'm not saying that Tony Schwartz was a stenographer,
mm-hmm.
but the voice would have been Donald Trump's for the most part. But that book sold over 1 million copies. Tony Schwartz made millions with an S, millions of dollars on that book over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the Don Advo question. When is Tony Schwartz, because he's so remorseful and so regretful, going to send that money back to Random House? Or has he already done it?
Mm-hmm.
Has he returned all of the royalties that he made on the book? Because when you sign on as a ghostwriter, you sign a non-disclosure agreement. Now, I don't think Random House likes Donald Trump very much, and I sort of think they would have let him out of that clause, and that's why he would have suddenly gone public. I don't think Tony Schwartz would have suddenly decided to jump into the spotlight if he thought that Random House was going to sue him. But you sign a non-disclosure agreement when you do that kind of work. You take on the job of being the voice of the subject of the book whose name is going to be on the book.
Mm-hmm.
Tony Schwartz is basically reneged on his part of the agreement, albeit 29 years later. Is he going to return the 29 years worth of royalties?
There's a good question. Okay.
Let's
move to the next headline.
Okay, I'm going to give you a few headlines, and we don't even have to go very deep into the articles. From August 13th, 2016, the headline appeared in the New York Times, Donald Trump is making America meaner. Okay, if you read the article, you find out that there was a community in Forest Grove, Oregon, wherein a bunch of people, a bunch of kids, it's a high school, at a high school, a bunch of high school kids in the middle of a physics class yelled at some Latino classmates, build a wall, build a wall. Those same white students had earlier chanted Trump, Trump, Trump. Kids in a high school hazing one another, yelling things at one another, warrants a story in the New York Times and deserves the headline, Donald Trump is making America meaner?
Especially when look at the Don't Make the Black Kids Angry YouTube channel of Colin Flaherty. I mention him often, and he just documents over and over and over, either from cell phone videos that black kids upload themselves or security cameras and things that get on local news. In schools, all of this mob black violence, often aimed against whites. You know, there's all these videos, even from everywhere, of white kids getting beat up by blacks, and it doesn't get on the news. He had one just a few days ago of a 17-year-old black boy hitting a 5-year-old white girl, and then on a school bus, and it was videoed by the school bus's video camera. And then when the news people went and talked to the superintendent of the school, she said, well, this type of stuff goes on all the time. That's not out of the normal.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, and there could have been some exceptional injuries or whatever, but I wouldn't think that that's newsworthy either. But, you know, I'm shocked that some kids taunting some other kids in a high school, and, you know, kids say things. You know, build a wall is the thing you say today to Mexicans. And that's a New York Times article and worthy of the headline, Donald Trump is making America meaner? You know, if it wasn't Donald Trump, if one ethnicity's soccer team had beat another ethnicity's soccer team, you know, they'd be chanting, you know, the name of the soccer team. It's not the soccer team's fault. Excuse me. Since I wasn't getting so emotional. I needed to take a breath and I didn't. Okay. But since it sounded like I was very emotional, the key point, I think, for this podcast is, in my view, whoever wins the election in November, the traditional news print media loses. The New York Times, it used to be a very respectable paper, and I've just seen it stoop to a new low in this election cycle.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a history of some newspapers endorsing presidential candidates. So in a way, that's nothing new. But what is new is this full court press by the media at large. There's hardly anywhere in the media that is pro-Trump. I don't remember ever seeing any candidate from one of the two major parties who was just subjected to so much negativity from not just the news media, but from the popular media. If you turn on the late night TV shows, the hosts are, you know, they might throw in a few anti-Hillary jokes, but it's just nonstop. I was watching Colbert's late night show on CBS, and he had a running gig. I don't know if he's still doing it or not, but every day he would say, well, speaking of random acts of violence, Donald Trump, you know, speaking of such and such unattractive subject, Donald Trump. And that was just his running gag. It's full court. It's from everywhere. And the shows that are supposedly neutral, CNN has a panel, Anderson Cooper or Don Lemon has a panel. It's a bunch of people who are all anti-Trump and then one Trump surrogate. And I have to say, these Trump surrogates are just not up to the task. There's so many things that they could, points that they could be making, and they don't make them. They're just, I don't know where they come from, and to what extent CNN or others are able to purposely choose the most inept. But I've never seen anything like this, and I was not a fan of George W. Bush, and I just remember I couldn't understand why the news media was making him seem like a normal, intelligent human being when he didn't seem to be. I mean, I just remember seeing a tremendous amount of neutrality from the news media. You know, Saturday Night Live might make George Bush look like a mentally retarded child, and they did. But in general, there was really even-handed treatment, and you don't have that now. I've never seen anything like it, and I've been a keen observer of presidential campaigns, at least going back to 72. I mean, I even remember the 68 campaign, but certainly from 72 on, watching them very carefully. I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, and you're contrasting the news media with the, you know, Saturday Night Live and the comics makes a very good point. Is when you were saying that a lot of comics are hard on Trump, I just think, well, that's they can be hard on whoever they want. Maybe they're encouraged to do it by their network. Maybe they're not. I don't know. But you know, a comic has a certain amount of license. But the press, the New York Times, you know, a legitimate, respected newspaper.
Right. The PBS NewsHour, PBS,
yes.
Public.
Yes.
They have a particular obligation to be fair and neutral. It's not as if they have, an owner who can do whatever he wants with the establishment.
Exactly. So I do remember the George Bush era. I remember comedians were hard on them. I thought, fine, you know. But the press treated him like you're supposed to treat, you know, was civil. Mm-hmm. The press is supposed to be civil. And the press is supposed to be more or less objective, one would think, or at least balanced, if not always objective.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Here's another headline. To me, it's like a big deal. Big deal. I'm being, you know, sarcastic. It's like big deal. The headline is Mexicans accuse president of, quote, historic error in welcoming Donald Trump. Okay. So what? You know, they found some Mexicans who weren't happy that Enrique Peña Nieto invited Donald Trump to visit Mexico. Is that worthy of its own article? Okay. Maybe one. I'm going to read a lot of headlines, maybe one or two, okay. But there's just sort of this avalanche of these. I went through 60, I did a search for Trump on the New York Times website. And I went through the top 60. And they were all either negative or a few were neutral. I only found one positive out of 60. And the headline for that one positive one was something like, "A President Trump will actually help the economy." And it was on the opinion page, and it was written by Trump's economic advisor.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only one, you know, out of 60 that was positive, whereas more than half were negative.
Yeah, wow.
Okay. So here's another New York Times headline. No vacancies for blacks. How Donald Trump got his start and was first accused of bias. Well, a lot of people just read the headlines when it comes to news. You know, you go, you buy a newspaper, you read the articles that you're interested in, but how do you choose which articles you're interested in and which articles you aren't interested in? You have to read the headlines. Mm-hmm. So a lot more eyes fall on headlines than they do on articles. And your eyes fall on this and, oh.
And by the way, it's typically not the reporters who write the headlines, is it?
Yes, very true. I have a friend that works in a news agency, and I point this out a lot, and this is happening a lot with Donald Trump, is some good-hearted reporter tried to do a balanced story on Donald Trump, and then the guy that writes the headline will just spin it like it's a negative.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, this one particular article whose headline is "No Vacancies for Blacks, How Donald Trump Got His Start and Was First Accused of Bias" is not really even about Donald Trump. It's about Fred Trump and how, I guess it was in 1963, somebody claims, some guy named Leibowitz. Let's find his first name here.
Well, Leibowitz. That's John Stewart's family name, by the way, Leibowitz.
Maybe it was John Stewart.
Maybe. John Stewart would have probably only been born in 63.
Okay, Stanley Liebowitz. Stanley Liebowitz was a rental agent, and there was a woman named Maxine Brown that wanted to rent a Fred C. Trump apartment. And Stanley Liebowitz claims in this article, we don't know if it's true or not, but Stanley Liebowitz claims that he got the application, the rental application from Maxine Brown, and he said to his boss, Fred C. Trump, what should I do with this application? And Fred C. Trump said, just put it in a drawer. Okay, that's what this whole article is about. It's got Donald Trump in the headline, but it's not really about Donald Trump. And then it, you know, kind of like ties him in toward the end and mentions the art of the deal. But it's really an article that's pinned on something that somebody close to 60 years later is accusing Fred C. Trump of having done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, it's got its own headline in the New York Times on August 27th.
Yes. And yet, I mean, think of all of the criminal activity that Hillary and her husband have been involved in, and that.
Okay, you probably know this story. Here's the headline. Donald Trump uses death of Dwayne Wade's cousin to illustrate his view.
Mm-hmm.
So Dwayne Wade is an NBA star, and his cousin was shot, I guess, in Chicago.
Yes.
And Donald Trump said something like, this is just what I've been saying, you know, African Americans have to vote for Trump because their communities are dangerous. You know, mm-hmm. He's the law and order candidate. Well, you know, the headline, if you only read the headline, makes it sound like he's such an opportunist, and maybe he is, but, I mean, if you're running for president, it's a decent point to make. You know, it wasn't all that callous, if you ask me. But, again, the headline is, Donald Trump uses death of Dwayne Wade's cousin to illustrate his view.
Yeah. You know, he's going to be damned if he does, damned if he doesn't. You have, he is consistently, I mean, over and over and over, I keep hearing that, oh, he made a big mistake by attacking the Gold Star family of this, you know, Muslim soldier who died in Iraq, a Muslim American soldier. And, of course, there was only something like 8 Muslim soldiers who died in Iraq, Americans. There weren't that many. And you had this one from a Pakistani family where the man is invited by Hillary onto the stage in prime time at the Democratic National Convention, and it's just attacking, ruthlessly attacking Donald Trump, you know, using his dead son, his martyred son. If it had been up to Donald Trump, my martyred son, my son wouldn't have been even allowed in the United States. Well, if it was up to Donald Trump, his martyred son would not have been sent over on phony pretext to die in a war. But if it was up to Hillary Clinton, and it was up to Hillary Clinton, she was a senator who was, you know, a leading proponent of the war for the Democrats, you know, to go along with George Bush. It was up to her. He was sent over. He did die on false pretenses, and she knew they were false. And yet, he's attacking Donald Trump. And so Donald Trump, he's not attacking the family. He just says, oh, you know, that was he's attacked me very strongly. It's odd that he just had his wife standing there without saying a word.
Yep.
And somehow that becomes, you know, Donald Trump just ruthlessly attacking some poor Muslim whose son Donald Trump killed. That's the way it gets spun. It's so ridiculous. Now, Trump should have made the point that, hey, had I been president, he wouldn't have died. Had Hillary been president, or she was president, she does have responsibility for his death. I had tried to stop the war. He didn't make that point. He could be doing a better job, but I'm not going to fault him too much because he's the only person who could be up there. He's the only person with those resources who could have gotten himself in this position. He's brought himself so close, so I don't want to fault him too much. I just don't want him to screw it up because it's within reach now.
Yeah, I know how you feel, because it's so easy to second guess, and you're always thinking, why didn't you say this, why didn't you say that? But, you know, you talk enough, you're going to say something that, you know, somebody can twist.
You sure can.
In the course of a certain amount of time. We've got one that you, Dr. Slattery, will have a lot to say about here. How do Trump's conspiracy theories go over in the Middle East? Dangerously, is the headline. And the article goes on to talk about the comment Trump made that Obama founded ISIS. That's the headline.
Well, okay, what are his conspiracy theories?
Well, this is his comment that Obama founded ISIS.
I think he was copying me.
Okay.
I say that partly tongue-in-cheek, but on Dr. Duke's show, a week earlier, I had called Hillary the mother of ISIS. Now, I don't know. I mean, we do know that Hillary's got some people who are connected to the Hillary campaign are listening to the David Duke show. We know that because in her big speech on the alt-right, she quoted David Duke and Don Advo. She didn't mention Don Advo by name, just called him one white supremacist, said such and such. But, I mean, directly quoting our show. So it's not that far-fetched that if Hillary has people monitoring the show, that somebody from Trump's campaign might have been monitoring the show. I don't know. So I'm not formally taking credit for this. But at any rate, I had said that Hillary is the mother of ISIS, and then I have on davidduke.com right now a open letter to Donald Trump, and it makes a variety of points tying Hillary Clinton to the rise of ISIS. And, in fact, you had $500 million, and this, obviously Obama's the president. Hillary has been pushing she was the one who was pushing for both the overthrow of Gaddafi and for the overthrow of Assad. And we know from, or at least we think we know from, New York Times sources and others, that Hillary was pushing Obama and Obama was reluctant. But at any rate, you have things like a $500 million program to train moderate Syrian rebels were supposedly going to fight Assad, and they wind up taking their training and taking their weapons, and they only wound up, according to this General Austin, who was testifying before a Senate committee last September, after spending $500 million, you only had four or five fighters in the field from this program. Well, actually, at least four or five fighting on the side that they wanted them to fighting on, because people are taking the training and the weapons and then joining ISIS. So that's one source of Hillary and Obama really creating ISIS. You have another source in Libya with the overthrow of Gaddafi. ISIS took over lots of areas of Libya. You even have this picture of John McCain, who, John McCain is also one of these cheerleaders for what Obama's doing, but wants him just to do more of it. And there's a picture of Obama shaking hands with this somebody from one of these Libyan resistance movements. I think he's actually an Iraqi man, but he was in Libya, and is now said to be the head of ISIS in Libya. There's just a whole bunch of this, and it goes beyond even just only Hillary and only Obama. The surge in Iraq under Bush, at the same time of the surge, you had this so-called Anbar Awakening, where the army was giving lots and lots of cash and weapons to Sunnis in Anbar province to try to get them on their side, and apparently they just sat on the money for a few years, and then later under the Obama administration, then they formed the core of the early ISIS fighters in Iraq. So you can't blame that necessarily on Obama and Hillary, but Hillary and Obama, especially the decisions to overthrow Gaddafi and the attempt to overthrow Assad, is the number one reason that you've got ISIS that took over much of Syria and much of Libya. So I'm sorry to be so long-winded on that, but...
Well, that's okay. I mean, the thing is that it's hard to understand these issues. And I think that's how Donald Trump cuts through a lot of this. You've got to speak in sound bites, kind of. And so he makes jokes. I don't think he meant that Obama was literally the founder of ISIS.
I think he kind of meant it. I think he kind of meant it.
Maybe he did.
In the way that I said it, but when he was pressed on it, he didn't have the information. I don't know who his foreign policy advisors are. I don't know. He has surrogates. He'll have, when he made this comment, then his surrogates in the news were people like Rudy Giuliani. Well, Rudy Giuliani is the last person you want to have representing your view if you're Donald Trump on the Middle East, because Rudy Giuliani was all pro-war and all pro-invasion. And Donald Trump has been, he's against the Iraq war. He's against, these efforts to overthrow governments, to regime change and nation build. they have completely different views on foreign policy. So why you would have people like Rudy Giuliani speaking for you makes absolutely no sense. But that's what's going on. And so Trump wound up, Trump, I don't think he doesn't have a huge amount of expertise in foreign policy. But the people who do have a lot of expertise, and especially the people who have experience in foreign policy, are the people who've screwed everything up.
Right?
Because the people who have been running our foreign policy have screwed everything up. So having experience in foreign policy is not necessarily a good credential. What Donald Trump does have, it seems, is a good deal of common sense. He needs to surround himself with people who... can back his common sense up with a lot of, good examples and good arguments. So I do think that he more or less meant it the way I meant it. Not that he was actively plotting the rise of ISIS, but that the decisions he made had more than just, it wasn't just simply backlash, it wasn't just simply blowback, but, money that he was sending over, weapons he was sending over, were winding up, even the people that were the intended recipients wound up becoming ISIS. And then, of course, Obama and Hillary have been fighting against the people who would be fighting against ISIS. They're trying to overthrow Assad, who is the main force fighting ISIS, and then trying to bully and really threatening war against Russia, who is fighting ISIS. So, in my view... Trump did come back and kind of say he was joking, but I don't think he was really joking. I think he was, using a little bit of rhetoric, but, certainly not stretching the bounds of rhetoric.
He sort of speaks, he speaks in a way where you're not, I don't know, I think he has good instincts, and I think he makes these sound bites so they will appeal to multiple constituencies, and you can read into them what you want to read into them. This article, anyway, interprets the statement as being sarcastic, but then goes on to say that Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, publicly endorsed Trump and went on to say, this is an American presidential candidate. He has data and documents. And then the author of the argument says, apparently the sarcasm was lost on Mr. Nasrallah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Mr. Nasrallah, the Hezbollah is one of the main forces also fighting against ISIS. They have troops in Syria. Of course, Syria and Lebanon. I mean, Lebanon was basically carved out of Syria, the Syrian province. The Ottoman Empire, if you look at a 100-year-old map in the Ottoman Empire, there was a province of Syria, and Lebanon was carved out of that, as was Jordan and Israel. At any rate, they have a long boundary. Syria and Lebanon have very intertwined histories. And the Hezbollah, which is a Lebanese organization, has sent over a fair contingent of people who are fighting alongside the Syrian government and with Russian air support. And I think some Iranian advisors as well. And that is what has pushed back ISIS in Syria over the past year, because ISIS has been way pushed back in Syria, and they're on the verge of being kicked out of Syria. Okay, do we have some more headlines?
Okay, so I'll just touch a couple quick headlines, and I guess that'll be all. Further into the muck with Mr. Trump is the headline that talks about his reference to the Second Amendment, the little joke that he made. Obviously, he was accused of calling out people to kill Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
What Donald Trump gets wrong about sexual harassment is the headline in the New York Times, August 3rd, 2016.
Are they trying to say he's not very good at sexual harassment? What's he getting wrong?
Well, he gets wrong. They're trying to say he doesn't know what sexual harassment is, and implying that he himself is a sexual harasser. But all they can do is they go back to a 2003 interview that he had on the Howard Stern show, when he bragged that his then 22-year-old daughter was a beauty and she's got the best body. And then in March 2006 on The View, he would feel all right about Ivanka posing for Playboy. And they got a couple other quotes. There's another quote. They got a couple other quotes, but they're all old ones.
Uh-huh.
They don't have a single thing from after he announced his presidency. In the course of a life of a very public man, you're going to say a few things, but nothing is, you know, women should be barefoot and pregnant and half naked.
Right.
Is it not, nothing
well,
is so.
I mean, he does own the, what is it, the Miss Universe or the Miss World pageant. He owns a beauty pageant.
Right.
And frankly, the stuff he says about Ivanka and all, I find it kind of creepy, but I don't care. And it's nothing like what Bill Clinton's done that we all know about. I mean, Bill Clinton's really a serial rapist. And then you think of Hillary, and she's so weird. And this business with her and Huma Aberdeen, who's always with her. You know, I was going back, and I referred to her overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And there is video of her. She was about to be interviewed by CBS News. And there's this famous video of her. She's being told that Gaddafi had just been killed, and she just cackles and says, "We came, we saw, he died." And, of course, I went back and looked at that video, and I noticed for the first time that the person who came up and told her was Huma Aberdeen. She's with her all the time. They often stay in the same hotel room when they're traveling. They've just been together all this time. And Huma Aberdeen's from a very, very strange family with she's also Pakistani, but spent a lot of time in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, her mother is an editor of some journal in Saudi Arabia, and a lot of the positions of that journal, I mean, if you're going to fault Donald Trump on not getting sexism or having strange views of gender relations, you should see Huma Aberdeen's mother's magazine and the type of, you know, Islamic fundamentalist stuff that they push for. And, I mean, Huma Aberdeen is about to be the next, if Hillary wins, Huma Aberdeen is basically the first lady, the new first lady, you know.
Okay. Edit that one so that I just read the headline, and that's what I should have been doing with these. I shouldn't have been trying to comment on them. I should have just been giving you the headlines and setting you up for them.
Well, sometimes I'll have set up some responses and sometimes not, but...
Okay, the one good one, as I mentioned, is "Why This Economy Needs Donald Trump" by David Malpass. But David Malpass is a senior economic advisor to the Trump campaign. You've got one... "As Donald Trump calls for wall on Mexican border, smugglers dig tunnels." It talks about smuggling Nogales, Arizona, and I guess the wall is going to be ineffective. So, you know, why is Trump building it anyway, or saying he's going to build it anyway, I guess is the idea.
Yeah, well, of course, he talks about tunneling technology, you know, or anti-tunneling technology that would be built into the wall. You know, the wall, to me, is... partly metaphor. I mean, I think he's really going to build a wall, and I think the wall is really going to have a certain amount of effect. But it's really a metaphor that for, you know, being willing to take whatever means are necessary in order to secure the border. And, you know, if people come out and say, "Oh, well, you can't build a wall because there's this mountain gap on the New Mexico, the border between Mexico and New Mexico, and the mountains won't allow it, and blah blah blah," and these experts have said it couldn't be built there. So what? You know, if you build a wall in other places and it's gaps here and there, you have to use other means of securing it. So what? Yeah, to me, the wall is partly metaphor. The one thing I don't really get is why he keeps having to say that the Mexicans are going to pay for it. I'm happy to pay for it if that's what it takes. You know?
Yeah, I think most people would be.
Yeah.
Most Trump supporters anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, and if he gets Mexico to pay for it, how's that going to work out? It's going to be through, you know, tariffs that are slapped on Mexican goods or something. It's not as if he has to get Mexican approval. And when he says, "Oh, the Mexicans are going to pay for it," it sounds almost as if the whole project is just going to depend on his ability to get the president of Mexico to write a check. And I'm sure that's not what he means.
Right.
But that's how a lot of people would hear it.
Okay, I'll just end on three articles that are basically hit pieces all by Charles M. Blow, and I won't go through them because they all skip around. But he's got an article that was August 29th opinion pages called "Donald Trump's Bigotry." The 3 days later, "The Duplicity of Donald Trump," and this one was earlier in the month on August 4th, "Trump Reflects White Male Fragility." And those are the kind of headlines you get on Trump from the New York Times. And how objective do you think that paper is these days?
Yeah. No, I mean, the New York Times, supposedly the newspaper of record, but you think of its, not just its complete lack of neutrality in this race, but you think of the massive role it had in spreading those very lies that were the false pretext for invading Iraq, for instance. And then you think of it as the mouthpiece of all these people who are pushing, you know, to vilify Putin and vilify Russia and for policies that risk a hot war with Russia, a real shooting war. New York Times is just this horrible propaganda piece for the worst and darkest forces, political forces, in America and, you know, the world, really. I mean, the idea that maybe the North Korean news agency is somehow more evil than the New York Times is laughable. The New York Times does way more damage than any other news agency out there, propaganda agency out there. And people believe it. And, you know, in the Soviet Union, there was a lot of propaganda, but I think by and large, people weren't really believing it. The New York Times, because it's effective, because it's trusted, its lies do so much damage and has so much blood on its hand.
Well, people believe it, but sort of my main point and the reason I assembled these headlines is I think the New York Times and just by extension the media, and especially, you know, the print media and the news media, they're playing their whole card.
Yeah.
They're putting all their chips on the table. It won't be the same after this election. There's a whole generation going up and they're seeing it's just over the top.
Yeah.
You know, an article about some high school kids that cried out, build a wall. It's like the reporters are just looking for anything. They're so obviously biased. And older people who've got, you know, 50 years or 60 years of memories of maybe to some extent there was propaganda in it, but a more or less in their memory objective paper, their impression may not be quite as damaged. But young people coming up today, they'll see this and they will come to regard the New York Times as Russians today regard Pravda, just as a propaganda piece. As I said a little bit earlier in our talk, whoever wins in November, I think the news media loses.
Okay. Well, I think that pretty much brings us to a conclusion of this podcast. Was there anything else you wanted to add?
Nope. I think that's it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Professor Richard Sloan. This has been Patrick Slattery with National Bugle Radio. And please spread the word, like us on Facebook, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and we will see you with another exciting broadcast very shortly.
Oh, wonderful music to play us out.
Oh, that's great music. It was great.